What we want to do is, I'll ask a number of people similar things,
yeah,
so that we can get a thread. But I particularly wanted your comments,
yeah,
on what the valley was like when you came here, the farming, and you know how it had why you had to stop, and then the same whole thing with the land use and with the aquifer. You guys set?
Anytime, yep, anytime.
Okay, well, why don't we start with you? The other day you described the valley, you know, with the farms and so forth. When you first came here, if you just start by saying...
And we came here.
When it was, you know...
Well... The way we got here to the valley was my brother and I were both in the service. My brother was with Patton's troops, and he went through the bells and bowls, and I was in the Pacific.
Let me just put this over a little bit, sorry.
So we start over?
Yes, please.
Okay. The way my brother and I got here to the valley was after we got out of the service. He was in the European theater and had been with Patton's troops, and we had corresponded off and on while we was in the service. I was in the Pacific, and I went through the Philippines and the Northern Islands and ended up in Korea.
We're hearing too much of this.
All right.
Yeah.
So we start over again.
Yes, please.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Sorry.
Okay.
The way I arrived in the valley was after I was discharged from the service, and my brother and I had been corresponding. He was in the European theater with Patton's troops, and I was in the Pacific theater, and I'd been through the Philippines and through Iwo Jima and Okinawa and ended up in Korea after the Japanese had signed the surrender. In the December of 46, I came back to the States, to California and across country, and we were both discharged in the same month. And after we got together, we discussed what we had been hoping to do while we was corresponding in the service. And we had decided maybe we ought to go farming. So we began to follow the ads in the newspapers, and we ended up in Waitsfield, because Waitsfield had quite a large farm that we was interested in, and it was in our price range, or we felt it was. So we came to Waitsfield, and we met Mr. Jones, who had his farm in the paper for sale, and he told us what was the acres and the stock that was included, and we was trying to figure out a way to finance it. But he had previously talked to some guy and told him before when he left for the service that if he came back and he still had the farm, he would sell it to him. So he felt that we had to have a binder of some kind. So he asked us to give him a cash payment on the farm of $10. So this was a written agreement so that he would be honest with the person he had promised the farm to, or promised that he would listen to him and listen to him and see if he could sell the farm to him. So we started from that. And then when we went to the bank, we got in on a double GI, which is the first double GI in Vermont, which means that they would give us twice the credit towards our bank loan that they would one GI. So the finances went through, and we arrived here in the spring. And at that time, about all that was going on around here was lumbering, and agriculture. And since they needed a lot of produce and food for to feed Europe under the Marshall Plan, the government was buying some crops like string beans and corn and so forth, and we was encouraged to grow these products besides our dairy to help us finance our business. But the main business in the valley was lumbering and sugaring and dairying. And of course, like I said, there was some produce that was grown. There was potatoes, a lot of potatoes grown in the valley, and we grew string beans, and we grew soldier beans, which is a bacon bean. And as the years, we done pretty well farming for the first 8 or 10 years. And then as the equipment began to change and the methods of farming, we found we're going to have to keep investing more and more money. And after a while, we realized that we would have to invest more money than what we originally paid for the farm if we continued, because we knew that we'd have to buy bulk tanks and combines and redo our stable. So just before this happened, I bought my brother out, and when I began to investigate to see what we'd have to do to modernize our farm, I felt it was too great an investment for the return. So then I kept some of my stock, and I raised some stock and sold it and sold hay, but there wasn't much of a return on that. So I slowly was forced to sell parts of my farm off to development to get enough return to pay the taxes and make a living. And I think that this is what's happened to a good many farmers today, is they've found that the return wasn't great enough to pay the taxes and to be able to live. So we started taking skiers as a lodge to help, and on the side I started doing plumbing. So we took skiers for a number of years. We remodeled our house and put in more bathrooms and rooms. And for a number of years, we took skiers. But of course, that was just the winter business. So in the summertime, I worked at the hardware store downtown and done plumbing down there. They run a plumbing business. And after a few years, I went into business for myself. But today I find that the controls are so bad, or I say so strict, I should say, is that you can't make a living on your land anyhow because of the restrictions. I've talked to people around here, and by the time they get done going through all the necessary permits and so forth, they're already restricted to where they're not in charge of their own business anymore. And we keep reading it in the paper every day. Yesterday I was reading in the paper where a guy couldn't build his large dairy barn up in Fairfax, I think it was. And every day we keep reading things like this. Here in this community, we have somebody with a large aquifer that could very well get the investment to build a bottling plant to employ anywhere from 25 to 40 people. And we have people in the area that have fought it so that they fought it to the extent that it can't be done now. And to me, if we're going to make a living on our land, and if we're going to have our constitutional rights, like what we fought for all during World War II, I feel that they have to take the shackles off the people, that's all. We have plenty of skilled people in this state, and we have a lot of hardworking people. I don't know how we're going to make a living. The state of Vermont has been taking less and less taxes in every year, even though they're increasing the tax rate constantly. And the towns are the same, and where they have the county tax, it's the same. 2 years ago, I sold a part of the lot that this house stands on, 2.5 acres, to my son. And the following spring, I got my tax bill, and after they had subtracted the amount that the lot was worth that I sold to my son, I paid more taxes than I did the previous year. This can't be. I feel that we're reaching the saturation point in taxation, where every time you raise the taxes a little more, you put more and more people in poverty. And it's going to reach the point where people are going to get discouraged, and it'll do like a lot of other countries, and the working people will just either rebel or sit around and not do anything. And this has been shown in Russia. 3 years ago, we sent food to Russia, and they had so much food it was rotting in the field. I saw pictures in the paper where there's meats and everything thrown side the road because these collective farmers or whatever they were just wouldn't continue raising the food for the people in the city because they didn't get anything for doing it or whatever it was. They got discouraged in the manner in which they were treating to the extent that they wouldn't do it anymore. They just rebelled. And it may not reach that point for a while, but eventually I feel it will. One small example of that is the income tax. And you and I have heard it, and everybody has heard it, where somebody will say to you, I could have worked Saturday, but the government's going to take 75 or 80% of it, so I felt I just well stayed at home. Or occasionally you'll hear somebody say, I could have worked a lot of overtime this week, but I didn't, because I would have got less paid than if I hadn't. So some of them things have got to be straightened out, because as a democracy and a private enterprise, it's your incentive is driven by what you make and how you're treated. And if it reaches the point where people find that most of their money goes to somebody else, when they're the ones that work to earn it, you'll get some type of rebellion. How it'll take place, I don't know. Maybe it'll just be silent. People just won't do or carry on an effort that they should to keep the country in a position where they can do all these things they're talking about wanting to do.
I think you told me, by way of example, when you started out, you had a couple of teams and a tractor.
Yeah.
And I think you started to make the point that these were very efficient, and the amount of money for the combine.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, when we first started farming, we started with 2 teams of horses, and we had an old 1928 Farmall Fairway. And, of course, they didn't take many repairs, and most of the effort was with labor, where you had to have a man to drive them and do the work. But when we first started farming, it was a number of years you couldn't get machinery because it went to Europe. But then when it started coming in, they began to convert to silage choppers and balers and so forth. And then the price began to go up, and it increased the cost of farming by many folds. And of course, the price of milk didn't keep up with it. And every time you'd get a surplus of milk, the price would go down. So this is one of the reasons that farming's gone out. Now, a lot of people feel that they should support farming, and supports haven't worked. I was in an era when they gave a few supports out, but I feel that it was used in a lot of ways to hold the prices down, because the government had all kinds of commodities that they bought from a little or nothing for the farmers. And then every time the price started to go up, they'd throw it on the market to depress it. Another thing is that a lot of people don't realize it, but the millions of dollars and billions of dollars that are put in the farm and agricultural programs in Washington don't go directly to the farmers. All the school lunches and all the non-profitable institutions that got commodities from the government got them for nothing, but they was charged against the farm bill. And a lot of people don't realize that. But the farmers, out of what a lot of people thought was a subsidy, were feeding all the schools in the country. And a lot of soup kitchens or whatever they were, and non-profitable institutions and so forth. A lot of government institutions and all got free food that way. And it was all charged to the farm program. And I think that this is a misunderstanding. It's hard for me to argue what it ought to be charged to, but certainly it didn't benefit the farmer directly. And when the government got a big enough surplus, if something started to go up 2 cents, they'd throw a bunch of it on the market to depress the market. Or either that, they give it to a foreign country.
When the skiing first came in, is that when the farms started going out, or was there a relationship between the two?
I don't know if there was a relationship. I think that it just happened in that manner, that the people from down country were looking for some recreation during the winter. And I think that people that had enough foresight to start these ski areas, they were the lucky ones where the skiers started coming and you had a recreation, winter recreation business. If you stop to think, there's not much people can do in the wintertime. In the summertime, even around the cities, they go out the city a little ways and they'll hike trails and climb mountains and do whitewater canoeing or have motorboats on a small lake or something like this. But in the wintertime, they can't do any of that. And so they look for other ways for recreation, and skiing was one that happened to blossom in a hurry. Oh yeah, oh yeah. There's no doubt about it. But when the ski areas come in and people really started coming to the ski areas, there's a lot of people that came up here with money and invested in chalets and developments and so forth. And that, of course, stimulated the price of property in the whole area. And it forced some people to sell their property in that when the appraisers go around, if somebody has sold a piece of property within the neighborhood for twice what it usually sold for, 2-3 times, they use that as a figure in their appraisals. And of course, whether you liked it or not, and you lived in your little old house like you always had, you kept paying more and more taxes because they figured that if you did sell, you could sell it for more money. But as long as you stayed there, you didn't benefit much by it. But I would think that this holds true probably all through the state of Vermont. And today, they call Waitsfield a rich town. And I don't think they can continue doing that, because I think the price of property have leveled off for quite a lot. They put in state offices in the complex in Waterbury, and I believe that houses and apartments in Waterbury are probably now bringing more money than they are right here in the valley. And because of the fact that they've put so many state workers in there, that is, and they're not too far from Montpelier, and they're not too far from Burlington or the ski areas. And the last I knew, they was getting an awful lot more state aid than some of these other surrounding towns. And I think that sooner or later, they got to start realizing that they're catching up with everybody else.
The other day, you were talking a little bit about the economic base in Waitsfield with the telephone company, yeah, with Mad River Canoe. But with the telephone company...
Well, the telephone company is an awful good business. They're good to their people. But I was trying to point out the fact that there's difference in businesses, and it's necessary to have the telephone company, but they don't bring any money in. All they do is give a service to the people that are in the area, and so all they're doing is recycling the same money that's already here. Now, if you had a water plant in here, and they were shipping water in different parts of the states, they would be bringing money in the valley. Mad River Canoe is one of the small businesses we have in Waitsfield, and they employ a few people, and they ship everything they make outside the state or outside the town, anyhow. And, of course, this brings money in. I think you have to have an industry where you're selling something outside the community so that you bring money into the community. So it gives you more revenue and builds up the economy. There's a lot of services that are here that all they do is service the community, and I don't think that brings any money into the community. They're necessary and so forth, but what we need is a good business and employ a bunch of people and brings money into the community to build up our economic base. And this way, also, they would have people spending money in the community, and they would have a tax base if they build any factories or anything of that sort, or have equipment in the area. This would help our tax base. Right now, the only thing we got is, as I can think of offhand, is Mad River Canoe right in Waitsfield. Yeah. Manufacturers. And this water deal, I think, would be fantastic because it'd be the cleanest industry in the world. If you're just bottling something, you're not mixing a bunch of chemicals, or you're not burning a lot of fuel or to manufacture something. You just bottle and ship out. And if you spill a little on the ground, it's not going to contaminate anything. There's a lot of things that would bring more day. And it would also keep all this area open where the wellheads are. And that's, I understand, is between 1,600-1,700 acres. So, you know, this is something to think about.
Don't worry, you can cough all you want.
They just cut it out, that's all.
Yeah. In talking about this, I guess my next question is, you know, why are people against it, and who's against it, and those kinds of questions?
It's difficult for me to understand it. Because basically, I feel it's a constitutional right. The Fourth Amendment of the Constitution reads, in part, that no state will pass any law that abridges a person's right to life, liberty, or property. The sixth article of the Constitution, the second section, says that when the state law and the federal law or the Constitution, there's a conflict between the two, the Constitution is superior. You know, and you could go through the Constitution and see dozens of places that this applies. I can't understand where people find a difference between the different articles of the Constitution or the different amendments. I think one is just as important as the other. Maybe to different people, see? Now, you can say what you wanna, but if you take the first article of the Constitution, it gives you your religious rights, your freedom of speech, and it gives you freedom of the press. If any one of them, anybody tries to deny you of them, everybody's up in the air. But they don't seem to think about the others that don't seem to probably affect as many people. As many people, I guess, every day as these do, they seem to forget about them. You know, it to me, it isn't just. And when they say that it doesn't matter. It does matter, because in the sixth article of the Constitution, they call that the linchpin, the law of superiority. And they claim if you start breaking that, the whole Constitution will fall to pieces. And that's why they call it the linchpin, is that the quicker you start eroding a part of it, the first thing we know, our Constitution won't be affected at all, and then we'll be like all the other countries of the world. The thing I think that makes this country unique is that we have these laws that protect a person, whether they're rich or poor, or whether no matter what their religion is, and no matter what they want to say. They have a right to speak, they have the right to their own religion, and so forth, and so many other things. It's the framework of our whole civilization here in the United States. And if we don't abide by it, or if we don't like it, we can do like they've done so many other times. We can bring it up to the people and have an amendment, because there's 26 amendments. And there's enough people there was enough people that felt that this should be changed, and it was changed. And take 75% of the states to change an amendment, pass an amendment. So it's got to be strong. It can't be only a small percentage of the people. And this is what I fear most of anything, is that this country won't be what it was if this continues, because we'll be like so many other countries. As quick as we get somebody that has a little power or is dominant over somebody else, they're going to use their own laws, and they're going to interpret their power the way they feel like it. And this is the way other countries went down the road, as far as I'm concerned, whether it was Castro, or whether it was peace places in Europe, or whether it was Haiti. Now, we're all about Haiti right now, and we say they didn't go according to their constitution because they put this new president in. And they said that according to their own constitution down there, that we have their elected president right here in this country. Well, if we feel so strong about that, what about our constitution? What about when you want to do something with your property and you go down to get a permit to build a house on it, and the board sits there and you say you got to put 3 maple trees on a certain side of your house, and they have to be of a given size? You know, is this your constitutional rights? This is somebody's own, I think this is somebody's own feelings, how they'd like to have the house. But you should be able to use your property, I think, if it's not a safety hazard to anybody or a health hazard to anybody, in most any way you want. It might look ugly if I painted this house brown, but technically it should be my business. Maybe I like brown. Maybe 90% of people don't like brown, but it's my property. And if I wanted it brown, I think I should have the right to have it brown. You know, and that's why I feel about it. And it isn't worth destroying all our constitutional rights, or our constitutional rights, or starting to bridge the Constitution a little at a time this way, till we've eroded it to the extent that we don't have a democracy like it was recognized during the time of Lincoln, or even in 20 years ago. Lincoln said it's up to us to make sure that all these people didn't die in vain, whether it was D-Day, or whether it was on Okinawa, or whether it was in Corregidor, or the Khyber Pass, or a million other places, or Pork Chop Hill, you know. This is the way I feel about it. I feel very strong about it, and I feel that every man that went in the service was sent there under the laws of the Constitution. It's the power of the Constitution that lets our elected officials do all this. And you may find that maybe they were sent in sometimes to fight a bad war, or it wasn't justified or something. That wasn't the individual. That wasn't the citizen of this country. They were the guys in Washington that got the wrong signals. But they used the power of the Constitution to send our men to fight, to defend that Constitution and their rights. And they should keep them. They should have them. And if they want to change them, there's ways in the Constitution to do it. And I think that that's the way it should be done.
Now, yeah. Is there a noise I hear?
Yeah.
this issue divided along different lines, and I'm wondering if you talk about that.
Well, I think mostly that the people are divided along people that have come in recent years, and some of them may be a first generation, but I think that maybe it was inherited by their parents, you know, or that it came down through this way. But the people that are pushing it the most are people that have moved here in recent years. And I don't know, it seems to me that a lot of these people are in citizen committees and boards and feel that they've been endowed with the power of a dictator or something. Because I've heard rumors of stuff that has been said on the Planning Commission that to me is just mind-boggling, where it's almost bribery, where they go there and they'll say, well, if you let us cross your property with a path, we'll give you your permit to build your house. Well, I think that's bribery. Now, I heard one even worse about a week ago. I went to a place to work, and this young couple had bought about 40 acres of land in Warren. And it was divided by a big gully. And it was about 17 or 18 acres on one side of the gully. And on the side they wanted to, the remainder was on the side that they wanted to build. But they wanted to cut some timber off the 17 acre piece. And one of the guys on the board said, well, I'll be able to view that from my area, from where I live. And we're going to have you bring a forester in or bring somebody in to spot and show you what to selectively cut, because I don't want to look at an area that's clear-cut and not well-groomed. And furthermore, you won't be able to build on that in the future, at any time in the future. Well, I don't know what would give the board the authority to tell a person they could never build on their land. To me, that's mind-boggling. I think that's, I don't know where they get the authority. A state don't have a right to do that without having people, without buying it. They don't have a right. They can condemn your land, but they got to appraise it and give you an honest and fair price for it. Now, you go up to board and they just tell you, you can't ever build on your land. And I don't know what reason they gave for it, but this is what I understood from the young lady. And I said, this got to be crazy, you know. I don't know what kind of a country this is turning into, but it doesn't make much sense.
Now, tell me just if you can, basically the people that have moved in, tell me sort of what they stand for or what their attitude is.
Well, when they get down there, they want complete domination of all the property in the area. By that I mean they come to these board meetings, and on the development of this water and plant, some of them even suggested that if it was done, they ought to give a financial account of all the money every year, so they could determine what they could force them to do, like putting in a pipeline or whatever else, you know, because there was some question about when something like this could be done or how much it would cost. Now, they wanted to have a review of the books every year. Now, that's none of their business. I understand that over in Randolph, Vermont Pure, that last year they lost a lot of money. They hope, since it's a growing industry, I assume that they'll make up for it. But because it's a growing business, a good business, but of course they've expanded to quite a lot. I think they're in 22 states now. They're probably spending a lot more money than they have coming in, trying to expand their business. But So it's very labor intensive, and it takes an awful investment to get something like that going. And I understand that if you don't know enough about the business to get shelf space and so forth and be able to distribute it, that you probably could never do anything with it. But if you're savvy enough in the business so that you can get shelf space and know how to distribute and get, you know, get it out where people will buy it, that you can do all right. But it's got to be, I would think it has to be an awful big business, because you certainly ain't going to make a lot of money on a bottle of water. You may make 2-3 cents or something like that, so it means you'd have to put quite a lot of water out. But over in Vermont Pure, they done this, we had people from here go over there, and they use anywhere from 2 to 7 truckloads a day, and they're in 22 states. So a truckload of water of 2,500 gallons or whatever it is, fills a lot of bottles. You know, it's, I think people have overestimated how much water it takes to do it. I don't think you'd use any more water in a business like that hardly than you would on a big dairy farm, where every cow drinks 6-7 gallons of water every day. And then you use it for washing everything, and you use it in the family, for the families, 2-3 families on a farm, see. I think you probably use as much water that way pretty near as you would with a bottling plant. You know, because you use a lot of water on the farms.
Well, why are people against this then?
Well, you got a lot of these people think that it's going to affect them. Some of them don't want to see 3-4 truckloads go down the road in front of their house. And that's one of the biggest objections, I think. And they've stated that. And, of course, VPIRG's out here. VPIRG fights everything there is. And Mel Heron lives up on that hill. And she's been fighting this from the word go. And when she ain't here, she's out either in Burlington fighting the incinerator, or in Rutland fighting. She fought Vicon until she knocked them out of business. And then she's been up to Palisades. She's always fought that. She's fought the withdrawal of the Mad River water. She's fought Central Vermont solid waste. And she's a professional. Well, that's what they are, VPIRG. It's supposed to be an interest group.
What's it stand for?
Vermont V. Vermont Public V. Public Interest Research. I don't know. I'm not sure. But Nader's Raiders started that. And he started with college kids. See? And he went up to the college to begin with. He went up to college, and each kid paid so much of his interest fee went to that. And that's where he got started. And I think they got it all over. In every state, I think, you know. And it's supposed to be a public interest research group or something. And they try to tell everybody how they ought to run their business and how everybody else ought to run their business. And she came right out of college, and she's been on there ever since. And it's like the environmental groups.
One of the things that you expressed to me before was people like Ed Irish or the farmers really are 100% behind this.
Most of the local people and the people that really understand business, I think, are for this. In particular, people that feel that we got to have something to live by, and we got to preserve farms, and we got to preserve our rights. And the whole thing goes together, as far as I'm concerned, you know. And Ed Irish was in agriculture all his life. He was the Commissioner of Agriculture under 3 governors. And it seemed like he could understand as much as anybody how our economy runs in the agricultural area. And I think a lot of people in this town that oppose it are either people that just come in or else people that work here and live in Montpelier. It's getting to be a bed town. They don't want anybody to do anything out here to disturb their nice summer homes, or they don't want to be affected by anything that might be going on around here and have an effect on them. And they want it to be strictly a bed town. And I, you know, there's a lot of people that work national lives. They work for the state offices out there for the government. And some of them even go to Burlington from here to work. And I think there's a number of them, and with them and the people that have moved in recent years that have come in from all over, feel that now they got their house and what they want to do. Nobody else should do anything to interfere with their vision or the noise pollution, or the odor pollution now they got. Noise pollution, odor pollution, or sight pollution. You know, this is, they keep coming up with new pollutions. And they don't want, I think there's, in some respect, you got to fight, you feel that they're self-centered because they look at only their area. They got a very small telescopic view as far as I'm concerned. And they as far, guys like Ed Irish and I, and Sterling Livingston that died last winter, and these people you talk to aren't going to benefit by this. We're all men in our 70s. But through history, and having lived in this area as long as we have, I think this is the way we come to reasoning the way we do. I don't know why. We keep saying history repeats itself, and it does. And it don't start with a great big bang when some country goes to pieces. It starts a little at a time. And as you keep eroding some of the things that keep up your economy and your and people's liberties and so forth, after a while you reach the point where the whole dam lets go, and then you're in trouble. It happens in Russia. It's happened in a lot of small countries. It's happening in Cuba today. All you have to do is keep reading and finding out how destitute they're getting now that they lost Russia, and how the people feel there, and how they keep trying to get across to this country. And you realize that maybe communism and socialism isn't what it is all supposed to have been. I assume, theoretically, if you could do just what you're supposed to as a communist or a socialist, everything would be hokey-dory. It don't work that way. Human beings aren't that way. If you work all day today and the person next to you don't do anything, and when they get done, they pay him as much as they do you, or that you work hard after work at night and they take your benefits and give them to somebody else, is resentment. And people lose their incentive. After a while, it happens everywhere. And I talked to somebody the other day in this area, and they was from Sweden, I think. Norway, Sweden, I guess it was. And she says to me, I know just what you mean. I come from Sweden, and nobody wants to work up there because everybody gets paid the same or get the same benefits or something. And she says it's got to the point that people just don't work up there. So there's a lot to think about. And I think that history repeats itself. And we're going through a cycle that if we don't swing, the pendulum don't swing back the other way, that we're going to continue going until there's a rebellion of some kind. How will it take place? I don't know. It'll be just demonstrations, or they start blowing each other up, or do like they do up in Northern Ireland. I don't know. But I just hope that the legislature and the state begins to realize that something drastic has to be done, or we're all going to be in a gridlock. They keep raising the taxes and getting less and less every year, and trying to initiate more and more programs. and it just can't be done.
How do you think skiing has affected the valley? And I was thinking here, Ed Irish told me that he used to raise potatoes and used to be able to get, well, I guess like you did for the beans, local help, and then suddenly he couldn't get that help anymore and he had to...
Well, I think the whole economy's changed. I think agriculture has changed. I think that as methods have changed and your equipment is bigger and bigger, transportation is better, the processing is all better. See, I can remember when milk had to come in within a certain area. When I was a kid, all the milk from this area went to Boston. The milk from the Champlain Valley went to New York. And that was about the limit. You couldn't get it from California over here. But today, you can ship fruit, you can ship vegetables, you can store them, or you can ship dairy products and keep them fresh. So this has made an awful lot of difference, see, in storage, in transportation. And so you're getting competition from areas that can do things a lot cheaper because they have greater expanses of meadows and farms, and they can use bigger and bigger equipment where you can't on these hill farms, you know. When you go down the, when you go down these areas where they have a piece of equipment that plants 10, 12 rows, and you go in places like Idaho where you can't see the other end of a row, they can do it cheaper. They can use equipment to do it cheaper. They have much labor, less labor. So this is kind of not these areas out, in a particular hill farm, a little more and more all the time. And so this has been the process. Now they, I can remember when all you heard around here was Maine potatoes. And today, if you stop and think about it, we hear an awful lot about Idaho potatoes. So vegetables are being shipped further and further, and they're able to market in a greater area. So I think this has got an awful lot of difference. And the labor deal, partly, is because you just can't keep up with labor in farm marketing the way you are up here in raising farm produce. See, it's almost impossible. You can't get somebody around here for $4 or $5 an hour. And if you did, you probably still couldn't make a living raising farm produce. There's a lot of reasons for it. Now, some of it, I assume, is the even though, see, like in dairying, you ever stop and say about dairying? You can milk cows year-round, and you have a long enough period to raise crops to produce and keep your cows and produce milk year-round. If you go south of here, say you're going to Carolinas, you can raise probably two crops down there. So why couldn't you ship up here? Now there were Vidalia onions were on the market a month and a half ago, weren't they? A month ago? So there's the first crop right there. Well, there's no reason why they couldn't raise another crop or two between now and fall. Up here, you can't do that. You know, it's impossible to raise two crops up here in this country. And there's a lot of things that you didn't used to be able to raise that you can now up here, only because that they've been able to hybrid of hybrid seed and crosses of all kinds, so they shorten the season. When I was young, corn didn't always mature. And it didn't always mature because it was corn that took 85, 90 days for it to mature. And today you can get corn that matures in 65 days. And you can get a lot of vegetables during the same way, see. But you still can't raise two crops up here of potatoes or onions or whatever you might. But you go south of here, and west, they got such great expanse there that I think there's areas out there that they raise two crops. I don't know if the season, I guess the season's longer, but they have winter wheat. And I think after they harvest the wheat, I think they have time for another crop because that comes in the spring pretty early. But I don't know about that. But it's the whole cycle of farming. This change through mechanism, through the processing, refrigeration, transportation, you know. In the wintertime, they send stuff here from Europe out of the greenhouses. They ship it over by plane.
Could you go back about the whole cycle of farming if you hit the microphone or something like that?
Oh.
That was a good statement.
Yeah. Yeah, farming has changed a lot in recent years due to the fact that the processing, you have refrigeration, you have better transportation, and that has made an awful lot of difference because it's expanded the market. It comes in, they ship cheeses, and in the wintertime from Europe, in the wintertime, you can go in these stores here and have tomatoes. Ripe tomatoes that are shipped in from Europe, and them are all greenhouse tomatoes, and so I think that farming has changed an awful lot through the years through all these different ways of handling and producing food, and so another thing is that they produce so much more on the same acreage. When I was a child, I can remember my brother was in an agricultural class, and he raised a half acre of potatoes for his project. And he got 225 bushel of potatoes to the acre. And they thought that was a fantastic crop. A number of years ago, when I first came in the valley here, Ed Irish was raising potatoes, and I read where he was in the 700 club. That meant he raised as many as 700 bushel to the acre due to chemical fertilizers, hybrids, and so forth. So, you know, and they've done the same with dairy. A cow will produce a lot more today than we did back years ago. It's just phenomenal what they do with some of these animals today. I can't quote you the figures, but back when I was farming, if you had a cow that gave 300 or 400 pounds of butter fat a year, you had an awful good dairy animal. And today they've surpassed, in fact, today butterfat ain't worth about that much. But they have cows, I guess, that give over 20, a lot over 20,000 pounds of milk a year now. And years ago, it wasn't like that. You didn't have the proper feeds. You didn't have ways of testing the proteins in your feeds and so forth. And all the studies that they've done in these universities, like UVM, Agricultural College and all, and these experiments have done an awful lot. And another thing that has changed dairy a lot is breeding. See, artificial insemination. Artificial insemination has given them the power to take a blood strain in an animal that's very productive and being able to ship their semen anywhere in the world to reproduce. And years ago, you didn't have that. It was just within a small area. If you got an animal that carried off, that had good characteristics that could carry out to their offsprings, it was just within a small area. But today, they take that semen and they can ship it anywhere because they can preserve it. And this has made an awful lot of difference in dairy. And today, they're also using the same as what vitro fertilization. They've done that. They're doing that in animals today. And if they have a very outstanding dam now, they can produce some herb by taking their eggs. Before, they used to use it just with the male. They could do it just with the male, but now they do it both ways. And there's some, I understand that there's a cow up here in East Montpelier that's worth over $1 million because of that. So there's an awful lot of changes going on in agriculture, and all these things tend to bring the price down in this area because it enlarges the market for everybody else, also increases the production. So that makes a marked difference.
And how has skiing affected the character of the valley?
Oh, you have a lot of different types of people come in. You have a lot of nice people come in, and But they bring in a lot of money and they spend a lot of money. But it's like it is all over the world. You got good ones and you got bad ones. You got some people trying to take advantage of it, and it brings in, and they have so many people going through here that it brings in the drug, the drugs and the thieves and all this. But that's all through the country, and this is due to transportation. A guy can be here tomorrow, and he can be in California tomorrow night. See, so I think that I don't think you could ever avoid that. And I think people, these type of people, drift to areas where they feel they got a better opportunity to ply their trade, whether they're pickpockets or what, you know. Oh, I think it, for one thing, it would employ some people. But I don't know very much about it, how it could be detrimental. Because in the first place, it shouldn't pollute the air in any way, because you're not using chemicals. You're not going to use a lot of energy, like you're doing processing some manufacturing goods. It's going to preserve the 1,700 to 2,000 acres up there. They won't be able to develop that or and so forth. So I don't know where it could have any negative effect. And if I was to choose one industry in the community, I would choose that, I think, over any other thing that you could do. I don't know where you could find anything it would benefit the community any more than that. That keeping 1,700 to 2,000 acres open without development and have an industry that doesn't pollute the community. And in case of accident, all you do is spill water in the road. You know, just spill a little water. I don't see where there's very much detrimental to me. I can't understand that some of them feel that you're going to drain all the water out from underground, but they've done all kinds of hydraulic studies and hydrologists, and the state has, and she's filled out all the requirements of the state, which is considerable, and the state has the authority to come in at any time and monitor the system, or if there's any complaints about anybody being a shortage of water, they can come right in and check it and make sure that it's not her system that's doing it. So, to me, I don't know why, but the people that think that they're going to keep this community